tonight that we're building a wonderful series. Peggy Morgan got us off to a wonderful start last week. And we'll have a wonderful time for a wonderful presentation and discussion tonight. Our speaker probably is known to many of you, but I will rehearse some of the details just for the sake of newcomers. Dermot Killingly from Liverpool studied Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit at Oxford, and later studied at SOAS in London. He then taught Sanskrit and Indian culture at the University of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur from 1961 to 68. And from 1970 until retiring in 2000, taught the Department of Religious Studies, University of Newcastle upon Tyne, and was the reader in Hindu studies at the time of his retirement. Also in the midst of that teaching, from 1984 to 2000, annually organized a conference on the Sanskrit tradition in the modern world at the University of Newcastle. In 1990, he was honored by giving the distinguished Westcott Memorial Lectures, also known as the TEEP Lectures, in Bangalore, Calcutta, and Delhi. He has a wide range of interests, including an interest in the Sanskrit tradition and its interaction with modern India and the modern world. His publications in the field of Indian and related studies include Ram Mohan Roy in Hindu and Christian Tradition, and The Only True God, which is also translations from Ram Mohan Roy, and also a book entitled Hindu Ritual and Society, from 1991. He's also interested, furthermore, in the presentation of Hinduism in the context of religious education in the contemporary scene, and has written a book for teachers called Approaches to Hinduism that came out in 1988. And on top of all of that, he's also developed a way of teaching Sanskrit, and his book called Beginning Sanskrit is about to be published. We have a very versatile speaker tonight. Professor Killingly's topic will be Christian and Hindu traditions in historical perspective.
Thank you very much, Frank. Just one little correction. The Approaches to Hinduism was not all me. It was me and Robert Jackson.
Okay.
So let's give Robert Jackson his due. He did the education bit, I did the Hinduism bit, more or less. Let's start by thinking of this word perspective. Perspective makes some things look big and other things look small, and it makes parallels meet at a vanishing point. And a shift in perspective can change the shape of a landscape completely, so that when you see mountains from the south, two peaks can be close together, and when you see the same mountains from the west, those two peaks are far apart and others are in between them. So a lot depends on difference of perspective. In the 17th century, a perspective glass meant a telescope. And it's a perspective glass or telescope enables us to see details, but at the same time limits the amount we can see at one time. And you can, of course, look through the... turn it round and look through the wrong end of it, which is what I'm going to do for part of this lecture. At least I'm going to turn the title around and look through the wrong end of it by talking about the historical perspective from the perspective of Hinduism and Christianity. So what is historical perspective? A historical perspective, as opposed to a faith perspective or theological perspective, such as one might find in a Hindu or Christian perspective, assumes, in principle, only what can be objectively known. And a historical perspective understands time in a different way from a religious perspective. And I think this is going to be important in what I'm talking about. In a religious perspective, time has a beginning and an end. Or in Hinduism, an infinite number of beginnings and ends. And between the beginning and the end, it has climactic points or peaks, and it has high times and low times. And these don't occur at random, they form a pattern. But since different traditions see different patterns, it seems that these patterns cannot be objectively known, and so the historical perspective ignores them. In religious traditions, some events happen in mythic time, which is always present, or can be made present. We see this in the Vedic hymns, where myths are often narrated using verb forms which imply the recent past. Indra has released the cows. Not Indra released the cows a long time ago, but Indra has released the cows, as if it had just happened. And sometimes the ritual itself can make the event happen. Some Vedic hymns say that the offerings will strengthen Indra to release the cows, or strengthen Vishnu to stride out to provide space for Indra to release the cows, as if it was just about to happen, not that it had just happened, but was just about to happen, and depended on the offerings being made in the ritual. And, of course, the Christian Eucharist makes present the passion and death of Christ. That, at any rate, is the Catholic understanding of the Eucharist. At the other extreme, you have the Zwinglian interpretation of the Eucharist as a memorial of the Passion, and, of course, there's a whole spectrum of different theologies of the Eucharist in between. But the Zwinglian idea of a memorial of the Passion of Christ, I think, accommodates Eucharistic theology to a secular historical view of time. Mythic time is also made present by relics and sacred places. To visit a sacred place or to see a relic is to be in contact with an event, regardless of its distance in secular time. So, to take an example, Ramatanka, a silver medallion picturing Rama and Lakshmana and Sita, is often taken to be an actual coin that circulated in the time of Rama. Some people who have these Ramatankas say that these are coins of the time of Rama, even if they look quite new. Or the sacred region known as Braj is full of places associated with incidents in the life of Krishna. Not only Gokul, where Krishna lived as a baby, and Vrindavan, where he lived later, the mountain Govardhan and other well-known places, but also dozens of spots which have been identified as places of pilgrimage from the mid-16th century onwards. There seems to have been a great activity in identifying places of pilgrimage associated with incidents in the life of Krishna. Some of them have since been forgotten. And further examples are Rama's birthplace and Sita's kitchen in Ayodhya, though, in fact, Ayodhya has more than one birthplace claimed for Rama. And the idea that the Babri Masjid, the Mosque of Babur, was built on the exact site of Rama's birth seems to have arisen first in situations of Hindu-Muslim conflict in the 19th century, and of course it has become a point of Hindu-Muslim conflict, unfortunately, in the 20th century as well. Christians, too, visit sacred places, such as the birthplace or burial place of Jesus, not, I think, in the same way as they visit the birthplace of Shakespeare, but because a visit to such a sacred place collapses the time between the event and the present. And Christian relics, pieces of the true cross, bones of the saints, and so on, serve the same purpose. Historical time, or profane time, or secular time, is uniform. Whereas the sacred time known to religious traditions has its time axes and patterns. Furthermore, these climaxes do not recede into the past so that we're further and further away from them as time goes on. We can bridge the distance between them and us by performing rituals, by looking at relics, and so on. At the Christian Eucharist, Christ's passion is made present so that communicants can receive its benefits. And similarly, in a Hindu ritual drama, when Rama is shown defeating Ravana at the Dasara festival in the Punjab, for instance, or when Draupadi washes her hair in the Duryodhana's blood in the Tamil summer festival of Draupadi, the events are not just being reenacted, they're happening in the present. And some say that what religions have in common is that they deny that our existence ends at death. The anthropologist Leach takes this as a definition of religion. But I would widen the statement by considering that death is only an aspect of time. In Sanskrit, the word kala can mean either death or time. And what religions have in common is the denial that time is linear and uniform and unrepeatable. In a secular perspective, time is featureless. We've only learned to measure time by observing the sun and the moon and mapping time out with days and months and years. In the last few hundred years, of course, we've learned to replace these natural markers of time with mechanical markers or even electronic markers of time, clocks and watches and so on, BIOS chips, which mark time in a more uniform way than the sun and the moon do. And we can still enjoy the sunrise or the full moon or the lengthening of the days after midwinter just as an aesthetic experience, but we no longer rely on them to measure time for us. And for that, we use something we can hold in our hands. And so secular time has become even more trivial than it was before. The great Christian poet of the 20th century, T.S. Eliot, talks about this featureless secular time through the image of the ocean, which constantly moves with, I quote, the groundswell that is and was from the beginning. This is from his poem, The Dry Salvages, one of the four quartets. The ocean, he says, is littered with wreckage left by humans, but it continues, regardless of that, in its own rhythm without considering human life. And this ocean represents, I quote again, time not our time, rung by the unhurried groundswell, a time older than the time of chronometers. And this time I'll give you a longer quotation from two stanzas from a longer passage in the Dry Salvages, which I think sum up this featureless nature of time. There is no end but addition, the trailing consequence of further days and hours, while emotion takes to itself the emotionless years of living among the breakage of what was believed in as the most reliable and therefore the fittest for renunciation. Where is the end of them, the fisherman sailing into the wind's tail where the fog cowers? We cannot think of a time that is oceanless, or of an ocean not littered with wastage, or of a future that is not liable, like the past, to have no destination. This bleak view of time, in which the future, like the past, has no destination, is the secular view. In other parts of the poem, and in some of his other poetry, Eliot is trying to do what he says we cannot do. We cannot think of a time that is oceanless. He tries to think of another kind of time which is not an ocean, that is not littered with the wastage of lost things and lost lives and lost effort, a kind of time that has a destination. But, I quote again, but to apprehend the point of intersection of the timeless with time is an occupation for the saint. And he says it requires prayer, observance, discipline, thought, and action. The historian, has no time for such a view of time, in which time, from time to time, intersects with the timeless. Sorry, I've been reading too much, Eliot. For the historian, whatever patterns are to be found must be found within historical events and not outside them. But that does not mean that there is just one historical perspective which contrasts with various religious perspectives. There are, in fact, several historical perspectives. And they, too, have their patterns. There's a Marxist perspective in which time is divided into a feudal age and a capitalist age and a communist age and so on. There's a Whig perspective in which revolutions and conflicts are ups and downs in a gradient which is always leading to something better. There's a postmodernist perspective in which the present time is radically different from preceding times, and history has come to an end. It always reminds me of A.A. Milne's poem about a child who has reached the age of six. Now I am six, I'm as clever as clever, so I think I'll stay six now forever and ever. For six, substitute postmodern, and you'll see what I mean. Christians have always contrasted their view of time with the secular view. The word secular comes from Latin seculum, which means the age, sometimes the century, as in French siècle, but sometimes it means the present age which will be ended when the new age comes. Dies irae, dies illa solvet seclum in favilla. The day of judgment will shatter the seculum, the present age, in ashes. And this idea of the end of the age followed by the day of judgment can be traced back to Jewish apocalyptic, where they talk about two ages, the present age in which good struggles against evil, and the coming age when God will rule unopposed and the forces of evil will be subdued. In the New Testament, it appears that the present age is close to its end, to be replaced by a new age, a new aeon, which is the Greek equivalent of Latin seculum. Now is the judgment of this world, this aeon, this age. Now shall the ruler of this age be cast out, John 12:31. Sometimes it appears that the new age is not just about to come, but has already come, Galatians 4:4. But when the time had fully come, or at the fulfillment of time, God sent forth his Son. So long as the life and teaching and death and resurrection of Jesus were a living memory, it was possible to believe that the old age has ended and the new age had begun. But as time went on, it became clear that time was going on in much the same way as it had gone on before. The two ages were not successive, the old age ending and the new age starting, but simultaneous. It was possible to live in the old age or in the new. In times of persecution under the Roman Empire, it was possible to believe that the church was suffering the birth pangs of the new age. There was no difficulty in believing in a sharp opposition between the present age with its oppressive rulers and the new age, even if the new age could only be entered now through death. While we live, we have to live in secular time. As for the day of judgment, it clearly had not arrived yet. It would arrive only when the coexistence of the two ages was ended and the secular age was shattered in ashes, as that poem Dies Irae says. This situation was changed early in the 4th century when Constantine became the first Roman emperor to support Christianity in 312 CE. The church was now the dominant institution of the present age and not something opposed to it. The rise of monasticism, which took place at about the same time, restored the opposition between the secular and the eternal. And by entering a monastery, one leaves this world, the secular world, or one has a double life in the world to some extent and out of it to some extent. I've suggested that the very early church was little concerned with the secular time with which historians deal. And yet, isn't Christianity, in contrast with Hinduism, very firmly anchored in secular time? Jesus is mentioned not only in the New Testament, but in non-Christian sources, in Tacitus in the Roman world and in Josephus in the Jewish world. And already in the Gospels, we find Matthew and Luke mentioning that Jesus is born under Herod the Great, and Luke tells us further that he was born at the time of the census held when Quirinius was governor in Syria. So, birth of Jesus is anchored in secular time, and it seems to be a concern of these gospel writers to make it clear that this was so. But this attempt at precision is not as precise as it seems. The census was 10 years after Herod's death. Luke, of course, may have been just mistaken, or he may have been stretching the material available to him to make a theological point that Jesus was born for the Gentile world represented by Roman power as well as for the Jews. It wasn't until the 6th century that Dionysius Exiguus devised a system for counting the years from the birth of Christ. Till then, years had been reckoned in various ways. The Romans had a system of counting years from the foundation of Rome. Jews sometimes counted from the creation of the world. But Jewish authorities differed as to when exactly that was, and it wasn't until the 12th century that they settled on 3761 BCE. But commonly, years were reckoned from the accession of particular kings or emperors, so that one era was quickly superseded by another, and different eras could coexist at the same time. Dionysius Exiguus adapted, in the 6th century, adapted this idea of dating by the accession of kings by reckoning from the birth of Christ, which could not be superseded because Christ was king forever. He thus gave us a way of measuring secular time which was permanent and suitable for a time when people had got used to the present age going on indefinitely, and which was at the same time distinctively Christian, since the dates were distinguished by the phrase Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord. Like Luke, Dionysius got the dating wrong. Jesus is now thought to have been born about 4 years earlier than he thought, in the reign of Herod the Great, of course. And in the present pluralistic age, people who are particular about these things don't call it AD anymore, they call it CE for common era, to avoid the implication that everyone is expected to call Jesus Lord. However, the majority of the population, people who haven't done religious studies, carry on calling it AD, unaware of what it means anyway. Dionysius' Christian project has become secular. In ancient India, too, it was common practice to date years from the accession of kings. Usually, the descendants of a king kept the same era, but dozens of dynasties in different parts of India had different eras. And even today, you can pick up an Indian book and find a date on it, which may be in the Vikrama era from 57 BCE, or the Shaka era, 78 CE, or the Bengal era, 593 CE, or, of course, in the Common Era. But in announcing the date at the beginning of a ritual, for instance in a marriage, Hindus use the number of years from the beginning of the Kali Age, the present age of the world, which started in 3102 BCE. We are now in year 5104 of the Kali Age, and 5105 will begin in a couple of months, I'm not sure exactly when. Sometime around April, some of you may know more precisely. And this Krita age, Kali age, sorry, that we're in is part of a cycle which takes 4,320,000 years. beginning with the perfect age, then descending to the Treta age, which is not so good, the Dvarapara age, which is still pretty good, but not so good as it was, and the Kali age, which is absolutely terrible. We know because we live in it. And when this cycle has happened 1,000 times, that completes the day of the god Brahma, and the universe ceases to exist. And then there's a night during which nothing happens for another 4,320 million years. And then the cycles of Krita, Treta, Dvapara and Kali age begin again. This cyclic view is based on observable cycles. The day, the lunar month, the year, in which we know that everything repeats itself. We know that midsummer will come again, even though it doesn't look like it now. We know that morning will come again. And the idea of an unrepeatable time, therefore, does not fit in with what we can observe and what we can extrapolate from our observation. The Hindu cyclic view of time is an extrapolation from observation. A corollary of the cyclic view of time is that nothing ever happens only once. If an event is possible, it will happen again and again. If it's not possible, it won't. And this contrasts with the Christian view of time, in which there's a unique creation, a unique incarnation, a unique atonement, and a unique last judgment. It also contrasts with a historical view, which shows a series of unique and unrepeatable events. There's only one Norman conquest. There's only one publication of the Hutton Report, and so on. If anything like that happens again, it won't be the same thing, it will be something analogous. The Christian and Hindu perspectives on time seem to be very different, but they have something in common. They agree that we live in a fallen world, a world that is not as good as it used to be, as we can see, because it's full of evil and suffering. Christianity has just one fall, from perfection to what we have now. Hinduism goes down in steps. Christianity follows the biblical tradition in dating this fall soon after the creation of the world. According to Jewish reckoning, as I mentioned, that's 3761 BCE. According to the reckoning that's prevailed in the English-speaking world since 1701, it starts in 4004 BCE. That's the date that used to be printed in the King James Bible. Hindu and Christian perspectives also agree that a time is coming when the world will be restored. In Christianity, this is associated with the second coming of Christ and the last judgment and the final defeat of evil, and is preceded by a time of strife and tribulation. The Hindu view is similar. This age will end when an incarnation of God comes to rescue the remaining righteous and to destroy the evildoers and to inaugurate the perfect age. But of course, at the end of that perfect age, it will all happen again. And by the way, it's no use waiting for the end of the Kali age, because it still has about 4,000 centuries to run. There are differences, of course. In the early church, the end of the present age was expected quite soon. And since then, people have made various predictions, but usually we accept that no one knows the hour when the present age will end. The sense that the end of all things is at hand, 1 Peter 4:7, has been transformed into a call to constant readiness and constant repentance. What if this present were the world's last night, asks John Donne. And he's considering it as a real possibility, and he's worried about it. In the standard texts of Hinduism, the end isn't imminent in this way. Nevertheless, preachers from time to time have urged their followers to bring about the return of the perfect age, because what's said in the standard texts is not always the same as what is in Hindus' minds. Hinduism and Christianity differ widely in their origins, not only in the historical origin that they have, but the kind of origin that they have. Christianity, in the historical perspective, originates in Galilee and Judea in the first century CE, an origin in a specific time and place. This is also true within its own perspective, with the difference that the Christian message has been prepared by God's covenant with Israel and his messages to the prophets recorded in the Hebrew Bible. Even more, it's part of God's plan from the beginning, so that Christ can be thought of as the second Adam, or the last Adam, as he is in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And later, Mary can be thought of as the second Eve. Here, history disagrees. So do the Jews, whose prophecies are appropriated by Christians with their own interpretation, which is quite different from the Jewish one. Hinduism, on the other hand, hasn't got the single origin in a specific time or place. Certain particular forms of Hinduism and certain particular Hindu practices and beliefs can be traced to specific origins. For instance, the Swaminarayan movement begins in the early 19th century Gujarat, and nobody disputes that. So can the sanctity of a particular place. Some things can be traced to the Veda. And the place names in the Veda, especially names of rivers, show that its geographical horizon starts in northwest India and gradually spreads eastward and southwards, as we turn to later parts of the text. The people who composed the Veda refer to themselves as Arya, and later the term Arya is applied to Brahmins and other castes wherever they live, whether in what used to be called what is still called the Arya country, the Aryavarta in northwest India, or anywhere else. People can still be Aryas. They're Aryas because they're entitled to participate in Vedic ritual. So we can see Hinduism as having multiple origins, some of it in Vedic times, some of it in much more recent times, some of it very likely in pre-Vedic times, though it's far harder to trace. This is the historical perspective, and it's acceptable within the Hindu perspective if we understand the term origin as referring to the beginning of the present currency of a belief or practice or set of beliefs and practices. But in the Hindu perspective, of course, these origins are really renewals. The worship of Krishna instituted by Chaitanya in the early 16th century, or the worship of Krishna as Srinathji instituted by Vallabha in the late 15th century, are not new because they restore earlier traditions. Even a new sacred place, which is new from the historical point of view, may have a myth of origin in which, for instance, Shiva appears to someone in a dream to say that his worship is being neglected in this place and should be restored. Or a cow spontaneously sheds milk over a spot until her owner sees what's happening and digs there and finds a sacred object which the cow has been worshipping with her milk. The image of Srinathji was discovered in this way. The classic statement of this idea of renewal is in chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna tells Arjuna that he has taught his doctrine to Vivasvant, the ancestor of humankind, and that whenever the doctrine declines, he takes form and teaches it again. If we consider this idea within the context of the cyclic view of time, we can readily understand that even his teaching Vivasvant is a renewal, not a first teaching, because the world is created and humankind is born again, and each primordial ancestor of humankind receives the same teaching. Christianity and Hinduism have different kinds of origin because they're different kinds of concept. Christians have always been called Christians because they believe in Christ or believe that Jesus is the Christ. There may be some disputed boundaries to the map of Christianity, whether Mormons or Moonies or Unitarians count as Christians or not. But there's a large area of undisputed territory. We know that Catholics and Anglicans and Baptists and Methodists and so on are Christians. Most of us know this. Some of us do dispute it, I know. But, mostly there's a large area of agreement. And if we want to decide whether a particular group should be counted as Christian or not, we consider where they stand in relation to Jesus Christ. Hindus, on the other hand, haven't always been called Hindus at all, and there's no clear way, near clear centre, no central belief in which, in terms of which they can be defined. Hinduism is polycentric, a term applied to it by Julius Lippmann in his book Hindus, Their Religious Beliefs and Practices, and this term is widely accepted as a very useful way of explaining what Hinduism means. By contrast, we could call Christianity monocentric. I don't know if anybody does, but we can. And to call Christianity monocentric wouldn't conflict with either the historical perspective or the Christian one. And this difference of polycentric and monocentric is reflected in the structure of Christianity and Hinduism as historical and social entities. It's true that even the early church had several centres, Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, Rome, but all these centres looked to Jerusalem as the scene of the culmination of Jesus' life on earth, and they all thought of Christendom as a unity. Christians consider unity a good thing, and division a bad thing. When Christians see disunity, they tend to think that something ought to be done about it. So either they pray about it. Last week was what I call the week of Thanksgiving for Christian diversity, but officially it's called the week of prayer for Christian unity. Or they seek reconciliation with those who differ from themselves, or they persecute them. The last has been the preferred option wherever the church has been sufficiently close to temporal power. From the time of Constantine to the decline of church influence on the state, which historians associated with the Enlightenment. In England, this decline was a slow process from the late 17th century to the early 19th. Hinduism, on the other hand, has a reputation for tolerating diversity. It certainly doesn't feel uneasy at diversity the way Christians do. Part of this reputation rests on a fallacy. The term Hinduism has a wide meaning which embraces many different religious traditions, but some people imagine an entity called Hinduism which is in a position to reject most of these traditions but chooses not to. But there is no such entity. Hindus can, in fact, be intolerant. The story is told that in the 7th century, when the king of Madurai in Tamil Nadu was converted by the poet Saint Nyanasambandar to Shaivism, he caused 8,000 Jains to be impaled. This story, Nilakantha Shastri, the historian of South India, points out, may not be true. I'm not claiming it is true. But the fact that the story is told shows that some people thought it was a good thing to do. And we know that violence against non-Hindus happens today. Not many would say that this represents the best in Hinduism, though some do. But we certainly can't say that Hindus are necessarily tolerant. The fallacy of Hindu tolerance is simply a misunderstanding of Hindu polycentrism. Nevertheless, there is, I assure you, a reality of Hindu tolerance as well as a fallacy. Whereas among European kingdoms and republics, especially in the Middle Ages and earlier ages, each kingdom or republic supported a particular form of Christianity and suppressed others. Each Indian kingdom supported the institutions of a particular tradition and not only tolerated others, but very often supported their institutions too. though not to the same extent. So Ashoka in the 3rd century BCE favoured Buddhism by supporting Buddhist monasteries, but he also patronised Hindu temples. And so did the Kushans in the early centuries CE. The Guptas from the 4th century onwards favoured Hinduism, but also patronised Buddhist monasteries. The ancient Indian ideal of the king who favours all religious institutions has been put forward as a viable alternative to the kind of secularism that we associate with Nehru. This difference between Christianity and Hinduism is reflected in the way the word sect is used. In Christianity, a sect is usually thought of as something which diverges from a mainstream church. In connection with Hinduism, where the term sect has been used, for instance, in H.H. Wilson's The Religious Sects of the Hindus, published in the mid-19th century, and in many books on Hindu sectarianism since then. When we talk about a sect, it isn't something that diverges from a mainstream church, because there isn't a mainstream church. And the word sect, in fact, is applied to what in Sanskrit is called a sampradaya, which means a handing on, a tradition, something in which teachers hand down their doctrines and rules of practice to their pupils and so on in a chain of teacher and disciple. And the existence of different sects in Hinduism, or different sampradayas, doesn't imply any hostility between them, and certainly doesn't imply that they diverge from a mainstream. While Christianity has a single origin, it doesn't have a single history. Christianity was divided in various ways from the beginning, as we can see between the lines of the Acts of the Apostles. And later on, there were all sorts of divisions. The great schism between East and West dated from 1054, but having its roots in events long before that, and exacerbated by events after that. The Reformation, which divides Catholicism from Protestantism, and of course many divisions between the broad different members of the broad category of Protestant or Reformed tradition. So Christianity has, to some extent, become polycentric, in that different groups of Christians recognize different authorities: Pope, patriarchs, general synods, general assemblies, and so on. But all still claim their ultimate authority in the same revelation, and each, of course, claims to be interpreting that revelation better than the others. We can therefore trace the spread of Christianity in Europe by tracing the way particular European kingdoms accepted Christianity and established hierarchies. The king patronized the church, and the church gave legitimacy and sanctity to the king. For instance, the kings of France traced their authority to the baptism of Clovis, the first Christian king of the Franks, when the Holy Spirit descended in the form of a dove bearing a flask of oil with which to anoint the king. And this same flask, topped up from time to time, anointed all the French kings ever since at Reims. To be a French king, you have to be anointed at Reims. The cost to the church of this close relationship with kingship is that when the French rejected the monarchy, they rejected the church as well. The relationship between king and church was complex, involving power struggles. To speak of church-state relations is an anachronism if you're talking about the Middle Ages, because there wasn't really a distinction between the two. There wasn't a seat as we understand it. And the Pope was a prince whose power depended on alliances with other princes. Bishops were feudal lords, while the king was not just a ruler, but a consecrated person. When Henry VIII rejected the authority of the Pope and made himself head of the church, he was only doing what Henry II would have liked to do and did his best to do. The spread of Christianity outside Europe, of course, is linked to discovery and conquest. Catholicism in South America, Christianity of all kinds in North America, the Protestant missions inspired by German pietism in India, and so on. We can't talk about the spread of Hinduism in the same way, not only because we haven't got the same kind of records, but because Hinduism is inherently polycentric. I haven't time to go into the question of what Hinduism is, but it certainly isn't the same as Brahman dominance, Sanskrit texts, Vedic ritual. So to trace the history of these would not be to trace the history of Hinduism. These are important features of Hinduism, which we can call the Sanskritic features, but alongside them are regional and local holy places, non-Brahmin priesthoods, vernacular traditions, tantric and other non-Vedic ritual. And we mustn't forget the tendency to assert the claims of these regional and local traditions and non-Sanskritic rituals by reference to the Sanskritic features, by claiming that the Tamil Devaram is the fifth Veda, that the Tamil Smith castes are Vishvakarma Brahmins, that this local goddess is the wife of Shiva, that river is the southern Ganga, that the Tantras are the fifth Veda, and so on. Such claims show the spread of Sanskritic features as points of reference, even where their influence is rejected. This spread, like the spread of Christianity, is due largely to relations between Brahmins and kings. Brahmins were provided by kings with wealth and protection, and they in turn provided kings with legitimacy and sanctification and diplomatic skills, literary skills, and so on. And there are many stories of kings outside North India, outside the original Aryan country, bringing Brahmins from North India to perform their rituals, make them legitimate, and therefore make them true Aryan kings. And in fact, the law book of Manu says that wherever Dharma, the Aryan law, is upheld, that is Aryavarta, although Manu also says that Aryavarta is within certain boundaries in North India. The fact that certain places are sacred in India doesn't mean that other places can't be sacred as well. And the same process has brought Brahmins, the Sanskritic rituals, and so on, to places in Southeast Asia. For instance, Thailand still has a community of Brahmins who consecrate the Thai kings, who are Buddhists. The Buddhists frequently use Hindu rituals. In presenting a historical perspective on Hinduism, I've presented a perspective which conflicts with some features of the Hindu perspective. First of all, the events I've mentioned as origins are, as I said, in a traditional Hindu perspective, reappearances or renewals of something that was latent before. Even the universe itself has no first beginning, but only a series of repeated beginnings. And the same applies to religious practices and teachings. Christianity disagrees with Hinduism. It does not have a cyclic but a linear view of time. There's only one creation, one fall, one last judgment, and so on. But Christianity also disagrees with the historical perspective in finding, for instance, that biblical prophecies foretell Jesus Christ, even if these prophecies have no messianic meaning for Jews. Or when Christians interpret conflicting gospel accounts as giving us knowledge of a true set of events, whereas historians tell us that these are different stories trying to fulfill particular expectations of what Jesus should be, and so on. Secondly, the Hindu timescale is often different from the historical one. This is strikingly so when historians date the Veda to the 2nd millennium BCE. When talking about the Veda, I refrained from mentioning any date for it. In traditional Hindu view, the Veda is eternal, so it hasn't got a date. And it becomes known at the beginning of the First Age, and later on it gets organized into the four Vedas. This happens in every cycle of the four ages. Different schools understand differently the eternal nature of the Veda, but they agree that it is eternal. B.G. Tilak, in the late 19th century, made a compromise between the historical and traditional view by dating the Veda on astronomical evidence to 4000 BCE and even earlier, thereby rejecting the historian's dating, but still giving it an origin within time. Later, other Hindu teachers, Radhakrishnan, for instance, accepts the history, but takes eternity to apply to the truths contained in the Veda, not to the text. Above all, while history can consider events as having causes or results, or even falling into patterns, like the Marxist pattern and so on, it doesn't consider them as having purposes beyond the intentions of the people who take part in them, in the events. There's no overarching pattern to the historian's history. There's no telos, no final end, no purpose. And both Christianity and Hinduism would disagree with history here. Christianity may not be more compatible with the historical perspective than Hinduism is. It may just have had more practice at living with it. Thank you.
Leaving us with time, since we have some time for discussion. Maybe just to start us off with a simple question, or a seemingly simple question, and then we can open it up. Would you say that a conclusion of your presentation would be that it would be kind of fundamentally problematic for a non-Hindu to write a history of Hinduism? In the modern context, it would be taken as somewhat of an aggressive act to try to take the Hindu traditions and put them in a historical framework. Because, as you know, some recent work by Western scholars has been taken in a very unfriendly fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it depends what historical framework and what Hindus. Unless you're going to accept, for instance, the idea that the the Vedic people originated within India, have always been in India, and the relation between the Indo-European languages has to be explained in some other way than migration from somewhere else into India and elsewhere, then yes, you're bound to offend some Hindus who insist on the Indian origin of everything Adi. How deeply you will offend them depends on how nicely you say it, but I suspect that however nicely you say it, you will offend somebody.
It sounded like a conclusion one could draw with that you end up offending many, not just a few. The very idea of writing a history of the religion is something rather foreign. And it has less to do with the dating of this thing, or that thing, or that event, or this event. But it sounds like you don't want to go in that direction. See it as that problematic.
Yeah. I think a Hindu writing a history of Hinduism and saying it starts with the Veda and the spread of Aryan culture eastwards and southwards will offend many Hindus. Because although perhaps this picture has become more standard lately with the rise of Hindutva, it's a picture which is rejected certainly by the Tamil nationalist tradition from late 19th, early 20th century onwards, rejected very vehemently. But I don't think one can deny that Tamil nationalists are Hindus. Some Tamil nationalists are secularists, but those who are not are Hindus.
Finality can be all in eternity, so that His petitio principi is complete.
Yes, I think I agree with you that, that the Hindu cyclic view of time is always contrasted with eternity. That moksha is essentially outside time, and truth is outside time, and the state of samadhi is outside time. Even though, from the point of view of the onlooker, the person who was in samadhi entered into samadhi at 5 o'clock and came out of samadhi at 6:10 or something. But from the point of view of the person in samadhi, that time isn't there. Yeah? This is the kind of thing you've been saying. That's an aspect of time which perhaps I didn't say so much about, but it's always in the background when Hindus are talking about it. Maybe this is connected with the way in the Sanskrit tradition it's very often you only get the final text of a science. You don't get the don't get preserved the books which were written before then. So in grammar you have the grammar of Panini. You don't have earlier attempts at grammar, although the grammar of Panini must have been arrived at through many earlier attempts. But in other sciences, this is so as well. You seem to get the final book. They're just not interested in the earlier attempts. Because once you've got the truth about something, you're not interested in the steps by which that truth was arrived at. You can only write commentaries explaining that foundation text. This shows a lack of interest in time in the sense that you haven't got an antiquarian interest. You're not interested in preserving monuments, intellectual monuments, or actual architectural monuments, just because they're old. You preserve what you think is good. Yes. I certainly wouldn't say that this anti-historical view is a typical Hindu view. I'm very glad to hear you say that. I have noticed that a lot of this anti-historical work comes from United States
very often by people who are highly qualified in something else, but not qualified in history. Is the study of history valuable?
No, value laden.
Value laden. I'm sure it is, yes. That's what I had in mind when I said that although history claims to be objective and all that, and to see time as simply uniform and featureless, in fact, historians do have their ideas of a pattern of history, and I don't think you can get away from that. Different historians may have different patterns of history, and historians may hold up as an ideal keeping values out of history. Though some historians may, Marxist historians, for instance, may think that values are essential to history. But probably history can never avoid it being value laden, whether the historian intends it or not. Sorry, Hinduism is?
Basically
an Aryan culture. It's an Aryan thing. But what about the Druidians who are living in this civilization and this being one of the oldest civilizations? What version of the practice? Yeah. Sorry, I gave the impression that I thought this spread of Aryan culture was Hinduism. Was the spread of Hinduism. In fact, I said that the spread of Hinduism can't be identified with that spread of Aryan culture because there are so many sources, Dravidian and other. Some cultures which are neither Dravidian nor Aryan are definitely part of Hinduism. So Hinduism in its origins is very much polycentric, and the Aryan tradition is one which is very vocal in the sense that we've got its texts from a long time ago. We've got Tamil texts from not quite so long ago. Some other traditions we've only got very recent evidence for. So we shouldn't allow this very vocal strand in the history of Hinduism to dominate the rest.
I think, unfortunately, our time, this worldly time, is up. But I think because it might be that Dr. Killian would be able to stay around a few minutes if anyone had any questions. Let us, first of all, back next week for the rest of our series.
Someone will move away and the rest will carry on talking.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sort of breaks up because the custom Nick says that individuals will be
can do it this way. Yes. Yeah. I should have a bigger pocket.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your presentation.